Good morning, everybody. I'll call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. The first order of business would be to approve the minutes of February 16th. Representative Dean, have you had an opportunity to read those minutes?
Not yet.
Representative Carlson, you're always here early. Would you like to move the minutes from the 16th of February?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll move the minutes from February 16th.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Yes, thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Howe was not present at last Thursday's meeting.
Howe
was serving our state and our nation.
Right. And we've noted that under excused members there on the...
Yes,
always on both places. Okay. So moved. We will have staff fix that. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Any other discussion on the minutes?
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
I see that Representative Whalen is listed twice as well.
Okay. We will take care of that. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Any other discussion on the minutes? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved and will be amended. The first order of business is House File 610. Okay. Representative Knobloch, the motion, I will move your bill, House File 610, before the committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division Committee. To your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 610 helps solve a estate tax planning problem for farm families that want to use a common estate planning technique. One common estate tax planning technique is to separate your assets, in this case farmland, into two revocable trusts of roughly equal value in order to avoid probate as well as take advantage of the estate tax exemptions that currently exist in law for each person. However, in 2012, the Minnesota Department of Revenue declared that different trusts could not be linked for homestead tax purposes. So a married couple that wanted to split up their farmland into two separate trusts to avoid probate or do their tax planning can no longer get ag homestead property tax status, increasing their property tax bill. This bill ensures that married farm couples are not forced to choose between losing the benefit of this property tax break that other people get or this common estate tax planning technique. In addition, right now across the state and rural counties, it's my understanding that county assessors are interpreting the law differently and in some cases are allowing this in some counties and not allowing it in other counties. So it would also clear up this confusion that exists across the state. This somewhat complex bill is supported by the Minnesota State Bar Association, which has been very involved in its drafting. And I also have Mike Sampson here, an attorney who specializes in this area of law, if people have other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Welcome to the committee. Did you have some comments that you wanted to make before we take questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Sampson, Maslin LLP in Minneapolis. I'm a member of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota State Bar Association. We've been contacted for the last couple of years by representatives outstate who say a couple of things. One is that depending on which county their client lives in, they're getting different results because of an ambiguity in the statute, which allows the Department of Revenue to decide whether trusts that own property are under common ownership. And we think that there shouldn't be a distinction between whether property is owned by husband and wife directly or in a trust if that has valid estate planning reasons. The other thing is we use trusts to avoid probate, especially in outstate counties, to capture the tax exemption for both spouses. And in the city, we do this a lot. We could take the house that the couple owns out on Lake Minnetonka that's worth the same amount of money as the farm and split it between husband and wife in revocable trust, continue to get homestead treatment on both sides, and get the estate tax planning benefits. But a farm couple that has a property of equal value that happens to be an ag homestead can't do it. They have to pick. Do they want the homestead tax treatment or the trust treatment? What this language in the bill does is clarifies that a trust that owns real estate that's created by a husband or a wife or that's for the benefit of a husband or a wife can be linked together and treated as owned by the couple, whether it's in trust or not, just to take away that ambiguity in the statute.
Thank you. Are there member questions for this testifier? Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this, well, actually, maybe we could ask the author, is this going to Tax Committee next?
It's going to the Property Tax Division, yes.
Okay.
Representative Lesh?
Well, maybe when it gets to taxes, I could ask a question. But if this, is this because a married couple can only homestead one property under current law? Is that what?
Right.
Mr. Sampson?
Madam Chair, yes. There's a provision in this bill that allows properties that are owned by a husband or wife or in different counties or townships to be linked together and treated as one tax homestead parcel. But the ownership by trusts severs that linkage. It is designed to allow the assessor to look at one property that's a couple as a unit, rather than looking at each individual trust as a separate owner.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think because if it's going to Property Tax Division, it's eventually going to come to taxes. Some of my other questions probably relate to revenue, and I'll ask them there rather than here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other member questions for this testifier? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify in regard to this bill? Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this does not fix the issue from when they form an LLC and they lose their homestead credit, even if one of the LLC members is living on the piece of property, if they're not actively engaged in the act of farming and they lease the property out. This does not fix that problem either, does it?
Mr. Sampson?
Madam Chair, thank you. No, it was... we decided to address the trust question first. That other question is a much bigger question.
Representative Al?
Thank you. That's the one I'm trying to find an answer to. Thank you.
Seeing no one in the audience wishing to testify and no other member questions, I'll renew my motion that... Representative Knobloch, final word?
No, would appreciate your support. I think it's a bill that clarifies some problems we've got in terms of interpretation between different counties, and it allows farm families to take advantage of the same sort of estate planning tax exemptions that other business owners and people have.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion that House File 610 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Property Tax and Local Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way, Representative Knobloch, to Property Tax Committee. And Representative Knobloch, we are going to...
I'm not completely on my way.
No, you aren't. That bill is, but you aren't. You're correct. House File 923, we laid that over during our last committee time. We ran out of time. And so that we will move House File 923 back before the committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
And Madam Chair, we talked about this bill last time, but just a real brief review. What it does is it basically conforms Minnesota to what's called Rule 68 and the federal usage of that rule. And it says that in fee-shifting statutes where the loser is required to pay, and in most cases it's the defendant that is required to pay in a lot of these cases, if there is a valid offer of settlement that's made at some point and it's rejected, and later when the court goes to trial, the amount that the plaintiff gets is less than that original offer, then the attorney fees that the defendant has to pay are only those attorney fees that were incurred up to the time of the offer. This is a bill to try to encourage people to stay out of court, to settle early, and it's prompted by a situation I had in my community in St. Cloud where we had a valid offer made to someone who was an employee of the St. Cloud Public Library who had sued. That offer was rejected. Eventually, when it finally went to trial, the employee received $10,000 and the attorneys received $91,000. And I don't recall exactly what the original offer was, but it certainly was no less than $10,000, and I think it was actually quite a bit more than $10,000. And so it would have been better for the plaintiff if they had settled then and for the defendant. The only people that really won out of the deal were were the attorneys. And I'm not trying to beat up on attorneys. The Bar Association was supporting my last bill. You'll see I'm not supporting this one. But I think this is a reasonable effort to try to encourage settlements. And I, in an effort to also try to eliminate some of the objection that I heard last time, I would like to have the A1 amendment offered.
Thank you. Representative Pugh, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes.
Get the bill in the...
So move, yeah. Madam Chair.
All right. The A1 is before us. Discussion on the A1.
Representative Knoblock, what does it do? What the A1 does is it removes Subdivision 1, which talked about how the court had to look at the attorney fees and the proportion of attorney fees to actual damages and awarding and certifying the attorney fees. And some people, we heard complaints that this was too prescriptive, that there's already language in the law that would allow the courts to determine what attorney fees should be, which is certainly true, although they rarely go out of their way to do that. But in an effort to try to allay some of the concerns that some people have, I'd like to have number one or subdivision one removed, because the heart of the bill really is the offer of judgment in subdivision two.
Thank you, Representative Knoblock. Questions on the A1? Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that take care of the concerns of the testifiers that we had? Is there anyone that can comment on it?
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to address the A1?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think it would be fair to say that there are still people that have concerns about the bill.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, are we gonna have more testimony from folks after this about it? Because I know people testified last time.
Right. I think there's still a couple of folks on the list here that we didn't get to last time.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I think I take the author at his word that the heart of the bill is still there, the offer of judgment, which is the major deal. And so I'm assuming that the folks who opposed it before are still going to vigorously oppose it. But I'd like to hear from some more folks, and I have no objection to the amendment getting in the bill in the shape the author wants it.
Thank you. Any more discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. We'll go to testifiers next. The first, I have Mike Hickey and Bob Johnson. I have them on the same line here as testimony. Are you planning to testify or not necessarily?
Sure, yeah, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, very good. Jonathan L. R. Drews. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jonathan Drewis. I am a small businessman and a small law firm attorney. I own a small firm that handles actually hundreds of lawsuits related to real estate. I am certified by the Minnesota State Bar Association as a real property specialist. And I guess my concerns related to the bill relate specifically to how it's going to affect my practice and what we're doing and how I'm helping people. And so I'd like to go through Subdivision 2 a little bit and see how this might play differently in an employment law situation than it might in a real estate law situation. Two of the key fee-shifting statutes that we see in real estate law, one is in mechanics liens, another is in recent law that came out of the legislature called 582.043. That was a law involving dual tracking. The idea being someone facing foreclosure is in a difficult position where they may not be able to afford attorney fees. If they're in foreclosure and they're trying to work with their lender at the same time to work out some sort of loan modification, this legislature decided that it was inappropriate for both to happen at the same time and that the bank would either follow one or the other. There's a fee-shifting provision there that says that a homeowner trying to work out a deal with their bank, if their bank is not working with them, and is still proceeding to foreclosure, they can hire an attorney and potentially those attorney fees are paid. This leads to the issue of what everyone was talking about when there's equitable relief sought in a case. For example, in that case, if I was retained by a client, which we've represented dozens of people in this situation, where we go to help someone try to negotiate a workout deal with their bank, and we file a lawsuit related to this, that bank could respond with, for example, a nominal dollar amount in this sort of offer of judgment. They could offer $1. Now, what we're actually seeking in the lawsuit isn't money. What we're seeking in the lawsuit, according to the statute, is to stop the foreclosure sale from going through. In other words, essentially put a pause on the process, hold everyone back, so that we can at least attempt to do that workout. I see a problem in cases where we're arguing about land or where we're arguing about that sort of an injunction to prevent a foreclosure sale, where nominal judgments, nominal offers could come out for a certain dollar amount, and that dollar amount doesn't really represent what the person is seeking to obtain. If they're seeking to obtain land, maybe we win the land at the end of the case. Maybe we win that injunction because the bank overstepped certain rules and regulations that the state has set forth. And yet, the ultimate verdict, as the proposal states, for damages may be less than even $5 because we win the land and we don't win $5. So if that $5 offer had been made, then according to this, our attorney fees are restricted and we're not allowed to seek our attorney fees. So in other words, my first critique would be focused on what happens when we're not actually looking for money. What happens when we're looking for something else? And I'll try to be real brief and quick here. The second point I'd like to make is that in my practice, usually this comes to a summary judgment motion. Usually we seek immediate relief, and usually there's a determination much earlier in the process than a verdict. The way that this is written, which is not how Rule 68 is written, this focuses in on the party claiming attorney fees does not obtain a verdict in excess of whatever the previous offer was. In order to obtain a verdict, you have to take it all the way to trial. So if I'm winning, so if I have a solid case and I go and I win early on in summary judgment motion, even if I win a dollar amount that exceeds the dollar amount of the offer, now I haven't obtained a verdict. So by the precise language of the statute, by not obtaining a verdict, now I'm not entitled to attorney fees. If you are tying a party's ability to demand attorney fees to a verdict as opposed to what a judgment is or what the ultimate outcome of the case is, then you are encouraging a case to go all the way to trial rather than to resolve prior to trial. The third point would be that I think that the proposal strictly prohibits an award of attorney fees when, and the language of the proposal is, no attorney fees may be awarded for fees incurred after service of the offer of judgment. Now, this is a statute. So this statute is going to control over any differing rules in the Rules of Civil Procedure. For example, if there is later conduct that is unbecoming of the party that had originally made the offer, now this statute literally says that a judge does not have the discretion to offer attorney fees. For example, a Rule 11 motion where there's frivolous litigation, frivolous claims. When we talk about proportionality rules in discovery, when a defendant potentially has gone beyond what they can reasonably expect to demand in discovery, in those instances, a judge generally has discretion to levy attorney fees against another party. In this sort of an instance, where the statute would explicitly say that no attorney fees may be awarded under these circumstances, you've just taken that power away from the judge throughout the remainder of the case, if you're to actually accept it as written. The proposal also requires, the fourth quick point, is that the proposal requires disclosure of current fees to the other side if one of these offers is made. This leads to gaming. I mean, this is a clear gaming provision where I could then, as a litigator at any time, make a $1 offer to the other side, and now they have to disclose their attorney fees to me. In fact, it might be advantageous to do this on a monthly basis, because then you're finding out what the other side is paying for their attorney fees, regardless of whether your offer is reasonable or not. So by offering $1 each month, then I get full disclosure of what the other side is paying for their attorney fees. This might be useful in negotiation strategy or litigation strategy generally. And then I guess the fifth point is just that judges already take into consideration the reasonableness of attorney fees. Statutes always say, reasonable attorney fees may be granted. And in understanding that, as a litigator that deals in cases like this, I have cases right now where there have been offers made, and I know that those offers may be presented to the judge at a later time to determine whether or not it was reasonable for us to continue with the lawsuit. Judges can take that into consideration. They can take the reasonableness of the timing of the settlement offers into consideration. And if that case sounds bad related to those attorneys getting $90,000, against the library. In cases such as that, then those arguments need to be made to that judge, saying, look, judge, it is unreasonable for them to get these fees because these previous settlement offers were made. Those are the main points I have on Provision 2. And if you'll allow me one more minute, in the litigation that we handle, often we're litigating against large multi-billion-dollar companies, right? I have three lawyers in my firm, small staff, and we may be litigating against Bank of America. In one case, FIA Card Services versus Patricia Naki, which is a case that we handled. The result was in 2012. And in that case, we were awarded, the amount of controversy was only $3,300 about. And we were awarded something in excess of $14,000. And Bank of America, FIA Card Services is a fully owned subsidiary of Bank of America. Bank of America, in that case, decided they wanted to prove a point. Right? For them, it's not about the dollars in that case. For them, it's about making law, making sure that they're right into the future. If you are taking discretion away from the judge, I worry about the judge's ability to do what the judge did in that case and say, look, Judge Dreher of the bankruptcy court that actually said, Bank of America, if you start World War III because you want to prove a legal point, you cannot then later hide behind the idea that the fees are unreasonable and trying to defend that. In other words, when one party has so much money that they have the ability to just bury the other side, the smaller person that's getting this fee shifting statute, they need the ability to defend themselves against that sort of attack or that sort of aggression. Those are my comments. If the committee has any questions,
thank you. Representative Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair, I want to respond to that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd love to hear this.
Representative Knobloch.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, first of all, if you go back to the testimony that we had in our last, in the meeting that we last took this up, we are really talking about money. We're not talking about relief by someone getting a parcel of land or a house or some other piece of property. This is about money, cash situations, not about reinstatement in someone's job or something. This only applies to money. So his first point is invalid. We're only talking about money. Secondly, talking about this issue of a verdict, a summary judgment is a verdict. You've gotten summary judgment from the court. If that happens, the verdict's been obtained, so this doesn't require you to go all the way through trial. This issue of a dollar a month, if someone actually only wants to offer a $1 offer of settlement, clearly if they've got any case at all and they go to trial and they win, the defendant is going to have to pay all their legal fees up through the trial because they're going to win more than a dollar. And so that doesn't give any advantage to a defendant. It just simply inflames the anger of the judge against them and is not going to be advantageous. Yeah, you'll be able to find out, I guess, how much the other side's attorney fees are, but you're not going to get any advantage from this statute because you're going to, if you've got any kind of a case at all, prevail and then be able to have all the attorney fees awarded up through and including the trial. In terms of the issue of reasonable attorney fees, yes, as I just acknowledged in holding out an olive branch and taking out Subdivision 1, there is statute that allows judges to change legal fees, to adopt some sort of standard of what are reasonable legal fees, but very rarely does that happen. Very rarely does that happen. We had testimony to that effect in the last meeting, too. And this idea of, okay, well, we're going to bury the other side by being unreasonable and just dragging them out. Well, I mean, if the only way they can do that is if they either, A, never give an offer at all and drag it all the way out to trial, or again, give an offer of a dollar or some really unreasonable offer, in which case, if the other side, if the plaintiff wins, the plaintiff in this case, then they're going to get their attorney fees all the way up through the conclusion of the trial anyway. So, again, I guess I don't think that those arguments are valid. I think that this, again, provides a little bit more of an even playing field and an encouragement for people to settle early as opposed to dragging this all through all the way through trial, when in certain circumstances attorneys have an incentive to do that.
Okay. Representative Lesh, to your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And after that response, I guess my questions are for Mr. Drewis. Is the author right what he just said, Mr. Drewis, that no, he's only talking about money in this bill, so this will only apply to litigation where the demand is monetary damages?
I can't talk to the intent of the bill, but when I read the language, it says, and I'm looking at line 1.15 on the copy that was outside, I guess 1.14 to 1.15, it says, to a party who claims money damages pursuant, in whole or in part, to a statute that provides for the award of attorney fees. So this is related to that. So if I bring a lawsuit against Bank of America because they violated Minnesota law related to a loan modification and reviewing someone for a loan modification, then I bring that law saying I want the following relief. One, I want an injunction preventing Bank of America from going through with this. They need to review my client for loan modification. And two, my reasonable attorney fees, that I'm entitled to my reasonable attorney fees for this. And those are the money damages that are pursuant to the statute. So, I mean, based on my reading of this, my impression is that this directly would relate to a case like that.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair Knobloch, you're wrong on that. It would apply to equitable relief. Let me ask this, Mr. Drewis. When Chair Knobloch asserts that a summary judgment motion is a verdict as determined by his bill, is that accurate?
I think when you look at I think when you look at Rule 68, you see that the rule is constructed in a way. And remember, Rule 68 is constructed by the Minnesota Supreme Court off of the advice and recommendations of a group of attorneys and lawyers and court administrators. When they do that, they look for those sort of problems. And so when you look at it, it doesn't say verdict. It mentions verdict, but it mentions a list of other occasions, such as orders and judgments and other things. This is restrictive only to verdicts. That may be able to be changed by amendment.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Drewis, I have a question or two. Let's say you got a client, let's say the Bank of America or another one, and an offer is made by Bank of America or the big dog that's got deep pockets, and whose decision is it between you and your client to take the offer or to proceed forward to trial?
Mr. Drewis.
It's always the client's decision. It's required that the client controls that decision-making process.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so what you're saying is that because of the termination, say the client wants to be heard or wants to get this equitable relief that doesn't relate to money, the client doesn't get penalized on this. It's you who gets penalized on the attorney's fees. Is that right?
Mr. Drewis.
I guess the situation that I see is Bank of America offers a nominal dollar amount but doesn't offer the relief that we're actually seeking, right? It offers $100 but doesn't offer that they're going to stop the sheriff's sale. And in that case, it's really non-responsive to what we're trying to accomplish in the lawsuit. If we were to take that offer, then I guess my client gets $100, but they don't stop the sale. If we don't take that offer and I end up winning and stopping the sale, then apparently under this, I'm not going to be able to acquire any of my attorney fees.
Well,
Representative
Lesh. Well, Madam Chair Knobloch would like to respond, I think.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, this is, we had testimony in the last meeting from Tom Marshall that underneath the Rule 68, this only applies to money damages cases. So I think that this is not a relevant line of argument.
Well, Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, we've run into this issue before, and this body has had to fix things on multiple occasions that I thought were indelibly clear. I think the language that we passed, agreed to by the Senate, signed by the government, was clear. Then the courts came and interpreted something totally different, and that language was clear. So to the extent this is vague at all, I think that warrants maybe a change or an amendment or something. But in reality, I guess I'd ask Chair Knobloch, I understand it's it's fun to beat up on lawyers, and especially when someone's out there and gets a judgment and, well, it's less, and so great, I won, but, you know, fine, I'll pay that, but I certainly shouldn't have to pay that dirty lawyer who pushed this through. And it's not just that I see this differently now because I'm in private practice, okay? I mean, I do work. I work my tail off, and, yeah, the client's decision, they want to, but sometimes I lose on those things. If I go to trial, I usually lose, actually, especially in criminal law. I'm losing money. And I don't like to lose money, but it is what it is, and sometimes that's the client's decision to want to do that. So I guess I don't really understand why you think it's a good idea to say, well, okay, we'll follow through. You can get justice as long as you don't have to pay your lawyer. I don't think it's a really fair way of operating the justice system. But second, your bill just favors those big dogs. It just favors the big folks. And it penalizes those folks who are living paycheck to paycheck and have a valid claim but can't now find anyone to take their case because, well, you know what now? All the big dog has to do is come in and lowball an offer, and that completely tilts the playing field. And I don't think that's fair. But I would encourage you, I highly suspect that this bill, which is incredibly controversial, as you've seen, is probably going to make it through here, considering how the committee is stacked. So I would highly encourage you to consider those other elements and whether an amendment is warranted.
Okay, and Madam Chair, if I can respond. First of all, I'm not here to beat up on attorneys, Representative Lesch. I mean, attorneys play a valuable role in our society, and this isn't all about big dogs. I mean, the reason I brought this bill is because of my situation in my community with the St. Cloud Public Library, who was a victim, I would say, of the way the statute is written now and how Rule 68 or the interpretation of Rule 68 was changed in Minnesota, where we had, again, a employee that got a $10,000 settlement when they could have gotten that months before. In fact, I believe somewhat more than that months before, and then the attorneys got a $91,000 fee paid for the library. So this isn't all about big dogs and big corporations against little people. This isn't supported just by the business community. It's supported by the League of Minnesota Cities as well. I understand that there are differences of philosophy here. I'm not trying to beat up on lawyers. I'm trying to create a situation where people have an incentive to settle at a reasonable settlement instead of having an incentive to go all the way through trial.
Thank you. Representative Dean, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm maybe even a little bit more confused than I was on Thursday. When we're talking about the case of a house, and maybe this might be to Mr. Drew or to the author, the bill speaks of money. But most of us have a lot of value wrapped up in our house. And if we're in a situation that ultimately we end up losing our house, wouldn't that be a money loss? Maybe not by the legal definition of this particular bill, but I would believe that that would be a money loss. I mean, if you could comment on that, Mr. Drewis.
Mr. Drewis?
Yes. So, again, I'll just look to the language of the proposal. It says, and the party claiming attorney fees does not obtain a verdict in excess of the offer. So if you're actually arguing about the value of land and you're arguing about who owns the land, then it goes to a question of, okay, how do you determine whether or not the verdict is in excess of the offer or not? So you're right. I think you could go to a judge and argue, look, the value of this land was more, or the value of this land was less than the amount of dollars that we offered. Therefore, our offer was better than them keeping their house. You can also look to other situations where we're in these loan modification related cases, we're seeking to stop a sheriff's sale.
Right.
So there's no dollar amount you can really put on stopping that sheriff's sale from happening. At least I'm saying that because once the sheriff's sale happens, then you have different rights. Before, you can still work out a loan modification where you're getting back on track and making a monthly payment to your bank, as opposed to after when you have to come up with a full lump sum to buy it out completely from the bank. So your rights substantially change in those circumstances. And so it's a series of rights that you have that you're really losing if that sale goes through, rather than a dollar amount.
Okay. Madam Chair, one other question.
Representative Dean?
Mr. Juris, you had mentioned mechanic liens.
Yes.
But you haven't really spoke to those at all. I'm pretty familiar with mechanic liens. I used to have a construction company many, many years ago, so I'd love it if you could speak to that.
Mr. Juris.
Yes. I mean, that's another area of real estate law where attorney fee shifting becomes, you know, very important. There are a lot of contractors that work on projects where they don't get paid. The mechanics and statute allows fee shifting so that they can go hire an attorney to go handle that matter. You know, I think that there is open debate about, you know, whether that is a fair system. And I think it goes to the question of, okay, you know, did that contractor really do the work? Did they do it well? Should they have gotten paid? And if they didn't get paid, then you should see that they get paid. I mean, I think that statute, which is really old, is focused on making sure laborers get paid for the work and contributions that they actually make. And I completely see the counterpoint of, you know, is it possible for an attorney to take up, you know, a small claim, work it really hard, and try to, you know, push the other side around on attorney fees, saying, look, now the claim is much bigger because of the attorney fees that I've accrued. I think reasonableness of attorney fees is a concern, and I think that's what everyone's trying to address here. I don't think that this is the way to do it. I think this body would be imposing on the court system a system that it thinks is right and better, even though the court system has tried to determine the best ways for trying to handle this. I mean, in 2000, you can read the advisory notes below the rule, and they describe how this rule differs from the federal rule. So it was very intentional that they differed it from the federal rule. And they say this rule differed from the rule before 2008 because they intentionally looked at those. They considered these options. You know, I'm not saying that our system couldn't be improved on issues of attorney fees. I don't think this is the way to do it.
Representative?
Just one last comment, Madam Chair, and Representative Knobloch. I truly believe that you're trying to protect the city of St. Cloud, but I get a feeling that this bill goes way beyond those types of situations that St. Cloud and the library in St. Cloud are dealing with. So I'm likely to be against this bill. Thank you.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for research. We keep talking about the rule of 68. I'm an insurance guy. Could you walk through what relationship the rule of 68 has to this topic? Then I have a question for the testifier.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, Rule 68 is a rule of Minnesota civil procedure, and as Mr. Drews just said, it's also a federal rule of procedure, so in federal cases it's a little bit different, but in state cases, Rule 68 allows for an offer, so a settlement offer to be made prior to the case going to trial, and the offer has 10 days for the other side to accept it or they can let it lapse. And that is the type of offer that they're discussing when they're talking about when the attorney's fees would cap in these cases, if the settlement then later, if the award from the court later came back to be less than that original settlement offer that happened prior to trial.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And to the testifier, am I correct in that I'm involved in a litigation, my whole reason for seeking legal counsel would be for the advice they would give me?
Mr. Drewis?
Yes.
And this bill deals directly with attorney fees, not with court costs, just attorney fees. If the advice I was given from my legal counsel ended up resulting in a smaller settlement than if they'd have said just go ahead and settle, would you not consider that bad advice? And would it be prudent to still get paid for the bad advice you gave?
Mr. Drewis.
So I think that's what the current Rule 68 is intended to address. So I completely agree. If the client is going to do better in today's settlement offer, then I better be advising my client that you know that's what they should do. If if there isn't a fee-shifting statute and I give my client bad advice, I know that that client at the end of the day is going to come back and say, no, you don't get those attorney fees. I'm not going to pay those, right? The same way, if there is a verdict determining that my client wins, then there's another proceeding that goes in front of the judge, and the judge then determines, is this attorney's fees reasonable or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that is intended to be the similar safeguard, where the judge can say, look, I see you billed $91,000 on this, but 6 months ago you got an offer for $10,000 for your client. That's the same that they would have gotten anyway. At the time, you were being overly aggressive. That was a stupid decision. I think your attorney fees aren't worth $91,000. You're getting paid $5,000. And the judge has the discretion in order to be able to do that.
Representative Lunin?
Yes. Finally, but this bill states that if a final verdict ends up being less than what the original offer was, in other words, the attorney got it wrong, that the attorney fees aren't owed by the defendant. I mean, that's basically what this bill says.
Yeah.
Pretty simple.
It says that it zeroes it out and removes the discretion from the judge to make that decision.
Representative O'Neill.
Oh, no.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knobloch, I'm back to the governor's veto letter from February 10th of 2012. In that letter, the governor specifically cites that the Supreme Court Task Force on Civil Justice rejected these changes. It states that it was proposed in 2008 and rejected, and then again December of 2011. So, Representative Knobloch, why do you think this bill or your proposal warrants going around the Supreme Court's task force that looks at these proposals? Why do you think you know that?
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. First of all, I guess I would say that now with the amendment, this bill is different than the bill that the governor vetoed. Secondly, I would say that we're the legislature, and we have powers, the courts have powers. You know, we're in many ways just conforming to what the federal law is in regard to Rule 68, so we're not talking about something extremely radical here. And I think that it makes sense. You know, Mr. Drew has talked about how, oh, yes, the judge has the ability to modify legal fees if he feels that it's been, you know, unfair or unreasonable. But in practice, that almost never happens. And so I'm trying to, with this bill, create a situation where there is more of an incentive for settlement, and where you don't necessarily have as many trials as you otherwise would have. In fact, Mr. Dean, Representative Dean, what he brought up, the mechanics fee, is, I think, a really good example of something where, I mean, I've been involved in the real estate and construction business for many years. I'm somewhat familiar with mechanics fees, too. They justly get filed when someone does work on building a building. Sometimes contractors, for whatever reason, don't pay. Sometimes they pay for legitimate reasons. They feel the work wasn't done right, it was sloppy, whatever. Sometimes they're just trying to take advantage of the subcontractor, whoever it was. And, you know, in my view, I mean, if it's a legitimate case where they're trying to take advantage of the subcontractor and the work was done right and the person should have been paid, well, then the attorney's got every incentive to take this all the way through trial and believe that they will get a just settlement, and then their attorney fees will be completely paid for. And they should be, because the contractor was trying to take advantage of the subcontractor. On the other hand, as also is often the case, if there are concerns about the quality of work, if there were disputes, you know, maybe there's a little bit of argument on both sides. Maybe there should be a settlement. Well, this encourages a settlement.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to make a comment, and then
sure.
I'll be done asking questions. Members, the governor's letter made it very clear that this legislation, when he vetoed it, that this legislation and the bad pieces are still in the bill. So the piece that negatively impact folks are still in the bill. So the governor specifically stated that over 300 Minnesota statutes require the shifting of attorney's fees to the wrongdoer, all of which would be negatively impacted by this legislation. Deployed military personnel, farmers, vulnerable adults, and victims of workplace harassment. Wrongful termination and discrimination are just a few of the classes of individuals that would be harmed by this legislation. In addition, Legal Aid specifically writes in their letter, Enactment of this bill into law would encourage and reward scam artists who prey on financially or otherwise vulnerable Minnesotans. Legal Aid sees many clients who have been victims of these sorts of scams, for instance, loan modification or door-to-door scams. Victims of these scams, which are typically for a couple of $1,000s, would no longer be able to obtain private counsels to be recompensated or obtain justice. So, members, that's what you're voting for today, and I would encourage you to vote no.
Representative Blush, did you have another question?
I did, Madam Chair. I would ask this. Representative Lunan, you write insurance policies, right?
Yep.
And if you wrote an insurance policy for a home, and the home burned down, and it turns out that the value contained in that home was much greater than the policy that you wrote for them, do you think you should not have gotten paid for writing that policy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that question. Actually, we are required, we have a suitability statute in Minnesota, and I'm required to document the advice I give the insured. Just like the testifier presented, it ultimately is the customer's position. I cannot make insurance decisions for people. My role is to make sure that they make an informed decision. So the obligation on me to not evoke my errors and omissions is actually to document that, in fact, I offered adequate coverage. Probably more accurate example wouldn't be a home fire, it would be auto insurance, where you've got people running around when they buy their insurance naming their own price. I have a problem with that. I contend that they aren't advised as to what that deficiency in coverage limits could ultimately cost them. But there is, we have a suitability statute in Minnesota that addresses that very thing.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Lewis, so you would agree that you probably shouldn't get paid then if that incident were to happen. Is that right?
No, I'm not agreeing with that at all. What I'm saying is my job is to advise my client, and that the client ultimately makes a decision. I cannot decide what coverage they do or do not buy. And the role that I play by statute is an advisory role. I consult them on it.
Representative Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lunan, that's exactly what goes on here. The attorney is advising the client. The client decides to proceed forward and gets a lower settlement, even if it's proceeding forward against the advice of the attorney. You're proposing that the attorney gets paid, that it doesn't get paid. So I presume that you would completely agree with the fact that if you gave a certain advice and it wasn't followed, or they wrote it for a lower coverage amount or whatever, that you shouldn't get paid. Madam Chair, I think this reveals the point that we all want to get paid for the work we do. We just don't want the other guy to get paid for the work that he does. And I think that reveals hypocrisy in this instance. I'm sure Representative Knobloch, when he was doing CPA work, if all of a sudden somebody, the IRS came after him for one reason or another, he would think that he should still get paid for his CPA work, regardless of whether or not the IRS were pursuing a client. But under a bill that would be written the same way as it affected CPAs, he shouldn't get paid. That has a great chilling effect on justice in the state of Minnesota, Madam Chair, and I think Representative Lunan recognizes that.
Representative Lunan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To clarify, actually, if I advise my client to not purchase something, to not do something, I'm going to end up having to call you for your services because I'm going to get rightfully sued by that client. That there's an expectation that I have a higher level of expertise than they do. That's the nature of the relationship, as it is with a lawyer and their client. And so if I advise for a lower amount and that's what they agree to, and then they suffer because of that because they don't get fully indemnified from the claim, then that's where my errors and omissions gets pulled in.
Any further discussion? Representative Knobloch, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? I see Mr. Carlson coming forward. Thank you, Mr. Drewis, for being here today.
Good morning, Madam Chairman.
Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
And members, Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. The first time I testified against this bill was in 1998. It's been around a while, and that was about the time that the St. Cloud case actually was being settled, and the lawyer who handled that case came and testified to the Senate committee. This is not a new issue, and I think that the intention is of encouraging settlement is a good one. I want to point out a couple of things on the language of the bill that I think discourages settlement, and I want to just bring that to your attention. If you look at the language of the bill, Madam Chair and members, despite what Mr. Marshall said, that both plaintiffs and defendants can make offers of judgment, this bill in front of you is one-sided. Only a defendant can take advantage of this bill because it says an offer of judgment made by a party to a party who claims money damages. So the language of the bill restricts this use only to the defendant, because the only party seeking money damages is the aggrieved party. And then, despite what the intentions are, on lines 1.14 and 5, the language that says in whole or in part absolutely gets to the equitable relief that Mr. Drews, who did a great job laying out the problems of this bill, really gets at. And in the St. Cloud case, just using that as an example, was an egregious example of sexual harassment in the workplace. The woman wanted job reinstatement. She wanted training on sexual harassment in the workplace. She wanted negative references removed from her employment file, none of which were related to the money offer. But because of the language on 1.14 and 1.15, in that case, from the date of that offer, they would be unable to be compensated for pursuing those other equitable reliefs. And whether that's intentional or not, you're not going to be able to separate those issues out in your fee request. Was I working for the money damages, or was I working for equitable relief? So there's just no way to parse that out. And I don't think the language works. And on 1.16, despite the idea that a summary judgment is a verdict, it is not. Verdict has a very specific meaning. So you have to take this all the way to trial to get a verdict from a jury. That's what or you can get a verdict from a court, from a bench trial. And lastly, Madam Chair and members, we've heard of at least a couple of instances where this applies in property-related situations. There are over 300 statutes that this legislature has approved to shift fees to the wrongful, to prevent the wrongful conduct and shift fees to the wrongful party, because we want to control that. Whether it's the mortician who has to collect his bill or the victim of discrimination in the workplace, those are there for a reason. And if you require on lines 1.18, after the date of an offer, within 10 days, I have to disclose to you the amount of my attorney fees, which I suggest to you violates the attorney-client privilege, because I'm going to have to tell you how many hours I'm spending, probably who I'm talking to. Why wouldn't I make that offer? That is a very problematic portion of this bill, and I would urge you to consider that, because this has serious, serious consequences. And I've been through the Supreme Court rule process, and we have members that serve on that, and so does the defense bar as well. And we've reviewed this issue in 2008, and this very issue was rejected by the court because it was unfair, and 2011 because it was unfair. And what they're trying to do at the Supreme Court is to encourage settlement. And the biggest change they made was to allow Rule 68 to be used by both plaintiffs and defendants to get defendants to the table. This takes us a step backwards, unintendedly, but this takes us a step backwards from that. That would be our position. We would urge caution, because the language of the bill, however well-intended, really has some serious consequences. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for this testifier? Representative Knobloch.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, let me just close by saying, first of all, in the interest of full disclosure, while I have my CPA shingle, Representative Lesch, I never practiced with it, so I don't have that experience in public accounting. But, the statutes we have, the fee-shifting statutes, are such that, and it's almost always the defendant that is put on the situation where they have to potentially pay both sides legal fees, that there's an incentive right now in some cases for attorneys to bring this all the way through the trial to, in some cases, get a potentially larger judgment and larger attorney fee than they otherwise would have if they settled early. All this is saying is we're encouraging people to settle early. Mr. Carlson talks about how unfair it is that only the defendant can make an offer. Well, the plaintiff's already made an offer. They brought the case. By bringing the case, that's their first offer. So an offer has been brought when they brought the case. Now the question is the defendant, the defendant's in a situation where they can make an offer and try to get something settled here, and then the plaintiff can choose to take that offer or reject it. And it, you know, he talked, Mr. Carlson talked about all the terrible things that this person in St. Cloud had happened to them. I guess I don't recall all the details of the case. It was a long time ago, but it went all the way to trial, and they got $10,000. So I don't know if there were certainly many terrible things that they alleged, but apparently the jury or judge didn't believe them all. But in any case, not taking any sides against that person. Members, this is about trying to encourage people to settle early. It's about trying to relieve some of the pressure on our court system. I think it's fair to allow an offer to be made, and if people don't like the offer, they have every ability to continue on all the way through trial, and if they were right, then they'll get their just rewards in the trial as well as the attorney fees paid for. So I'd urge your support for the bill.
Representative Hillstrom, did you have one final question?
I just wanted to make a comment that Representative Knobloch, while that person in St. Cloud did get less in damages, they also did equitable relief. They did get equitable relief. And so that is the very issue with your bill. It doesn't take into account equitable relief.
Members, I just want to make a statement here. And that is, if you have questions, that's fine. But once we give the bill author the final word, I allowed you to have that statement, Representative Hillstrom. But in the future, the bill author gets the last word. With that, we will vote. I will renew my motion that House File.
I'm sure that's for roll call.
A roll call has been requested. I'll renew the motion that 923 be re-referred as amended to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Lush?
Nope.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howell?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Lunin?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Whalen?
Yes.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move HF 1118.
Okay, and the motion, Representative Lucero, would be that it go to the General Register. Representative Lucero, do you have an amendment?
I do, and I will offer the DE1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the amendment, well, let's, if we could just do that, then I'll speak to the whole bill.
Okay. Any discussion on the DE1? All those in favor of adopting the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author wishes, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when it comes to real estate, there are several general categories of real estate. One of them is commercial, which we're not speaking about in this bill. Then there's residential real estate. And within residential real estate, it subdivides into two general categories, that which is non community interest, common interest community properties, and those that are common interest community properties. And common interest community properties are those that are more commonly referred to as a homeowners association, so townhomes, condos, etc. And that's what we're dealing with in this particular bill. So when it comes to the buying and selling of real estate, it is the normal process to offer purchase agreements, to cancel purchase agreements electronically. And there is, most people are familiar with the purchase agreements. When an offer is accepted, there are typically several contingencies in that purchase agreement, such as the inability for the buyer to secure financing. There could be a contingency upon an inspection if something's revealed that the buyer doesn't like. There are any one of those, the buyer can exercise the right to cancel. And then the notification doesn't have to be a physical notice of cancelization of the purchase agreement, but instead is conducted electronically. When it comes to CIC properties, in addition to those regular contingencies that are contained within a purchase agreement, there's a 10-day right of rescission in regards to HOA documents. So every common interest community has HOA documents, which contain things such as bylaws, the financial strength of the HOA itself, the cost of the annual or monthly membership, etc. And so there's a 10-day window, and that 10-day window can start at any time. It can start before a purchase agreement is accepted, or it could start after a purchase agreement is accepted. Whenever the documents, those HOA documents, are given from the seller to the buyer, that's when, or the buyer's agent, that's when the 10-day window starts. And if during that 10-day window, even if a purchase agreement has already been accepted, upon review of the HOA documents, the buyer chooses there's something in there that they don't like, they have the right to cancel. And under current law, that ability to cancel, unlike the other cancelizations of a purchase agreement, this has to be done in person. So all we're doing is simply conforming this narrow ability to, in regards to the 10-day cancelization for CIC, to conform to other cancelizations, Madam Chair. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ryan Hamilton. I'm an associate legal counsel with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Rep. Lucero covered all the salient points. I just want to thank him for carrying the bill for us. I'd also like to thank the MSBA's real property section, in particular Tom Bray. We've been involved in discussions on writing the language since before session, so they really helped us craft workable language. The amendment reflects our agreements, specifically the bar's desire that the parties are specific about where the electronic communication will go. Like, we all have multiple email addresses, so we want the parties to know exactly which email address they want to send the cancellation. And with that, I'll thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you for carrying the bill.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions? Wow. Representative Lucero renews his motion that House File 1118, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we are adjourned.